from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Dear white America, I've left Earth in search of darker planets, a solar system that revolves too near a black hole. I've left in search of a new God. I do not trust the God you have given us. My grandmother's hallelujah is only outdone by the fear she nurses each time the blood-fat summer swallows another child who used to sing in the choir. Take your God back. Though his songs are beautiful, his miracles are inconsistent.
That's the voice of poet Dennis Smith, who has really created a sensation with his work. He is a poet who identifies, not only as, in many ways, they are a poet, excuse me, yes, not only identifies with that bi-identity of not using, shall we say, the regular pronouns, but being referred to as they. Not only being a binary poet, but actually a poet who is black and a poet who is HIV and identifies as being queer. And I was really looking forward to talking to him, and I'm hoping that we will be able to. He stirred up a great deal with that Dear White America piece, as you can imagine, which went viral and which has been heard over and over again. And he has a new book out called Homie, which I was anxious to talk with him about. The problem is we're trying to connect with NPR, and we're having some problems. So we invited, and this is just a sign of how gracious she is, Gail Rode-Masanta to join us once again and talk with us some more about what we were talking about in the last segment. Actually, maybe a good place to begin here, Gail, if I could with you, is what about Ariana Prell put this whole segment together, and kudos on that score. And she studied with Ron Takai at UC Berkeley, who had a lot to say about multi-ethnic identity. And I'm wondering about your thoughts about multi-ethnic identity. People continue to say, well, the Filipino experience is so different from the African-American experience. How can you compare them? And yet they come under that bracket of ethnic identity. Your thoughts?
You know, I don't align myself with those folks who are saying, you know, the Filipino-American identity is different than African-American identity or other marginalized communities. I see it maybe because I grew up in Stockton and I, you know, I had relatives who already been here since the 30s. But I also was an immigrant. And so I kind of straddled two worlds of an immigrant and then also family who had been here since the 30s. And so, but because of history, knowing history, like stories about Larry Itliong, we are absolutely aligned and have many similar issues, many similar things that have happened into our with our communities, with other that are very similar to other marginalized communities. So when we talk about multi-ethnic identity, you know, I see Filipinos as part, Filipino-Americans as part of that conversation.
What do you feel? Do we have Dinez? Excuse me. Ariana? Not yet. Okay. What do you see as particularly similarities? Where is the common ground as you see it?
Definitely when we're talking about racism. For instance, in Journey for Justice, the life of Larry Itliong, the children's book that we were talking about earlier about Larry Itliong, Filipinos were absolutely discriminated upon and were physically beaten, murdered, hung out here in California. And, you know, there were signs we have real signs in the children's book or in the book that says, get rid of all Filipinos or we'll burn this town down. And in fact, in Stockton, California, where I'm from and where I grew up and currently reside, the Filipino Community Center was bombed. And so when people
Can you talk a little bit about that story historically, what happened, what led to it, or what was behind
it? So it was bombed. There was an anti-Filipino sentiment. People were thinking, especially during the Great Depression, that you had these migrant workers and
they're taking our jobs.
They're taking our jobs. Basically the same thing that we're talking about now. They're taking our jobs. Yeah. But Filipinos were migrant farm workers. And, you know, there were busboys. They were doing a lot of manual labor.
Service work.
Exactly. Service work. And so these things were happening in our communities. And so when people say that we are not part, or if Filipino Americans say that, or They say that we're not aligned with it, or we don't see ourselves as multi-ethnic or people of color or a marginalized community because our parents came here as doctors or nurses. It might be because they haven't read their own history here in the United States. And sometimes it's a radical thing to align with yourself with your history here in the United States, because Filipinos have been colonized for so long. They will identify with, the Declaration of Independence, or they will recite and learn so much American history. But when you tell them they are actually part of American history and actually were there, you know, in the Delano grape strike and have been making history, especially such a pivotal social justice movement as the Delano grape strike, they won't identify it as their history, even though it's American history, because of that colonial mentality that...
Yeah, I was going to say, in fact, let's talk about that, because they were a colonized people. The Filipinos were colonized by the United States of America, and certainly that plays into a lot of that sense of being outsiders and being maybe even victims.
Oh, even in their own country. Spain colonized the Philippines for over 400 years and had really... the language, the dancing, the culture, everything had infiltrated it. And the United States, Philippines was a colony of the United States. And so there's always kind of the ideal where dark is bad, white is good. Also, the United States is above all, and even Spanish. If you claim Spanish or Chinese or another identity other than Filipino, then it means that you're elevated in some way. And if you have lighter skin, that's even better. Your chances of success are even better. If you want to work at a fast food restaurant in the Philippines, you have to be of a certain height and a certain skin color. And so... all of these things, when you get Filipinos who come here and they immigrate, they don't want to be known as the farm worker. They want to assimilate as soon as possible, as soon as they can, and not identify with social justice movements.
Was Larry Etliang so concerned about assimilating, though? He wasn't really.
No.
Not like you're talking about.
No.
He kept his identity and kept it intact as a Filipino and as a Filipino-American.
He did, but, you know, he came here when he was 15, and so he was a boy in my eyes. I think of my 14-year-old daughter, and I think if she had come, if we were in the Philippines and she had come here, she would grow up, so much differently. Like, that's a young boy, and he grew up predominantly here in the United States. So definitely his identity and the way he spoke, everything was influenced by what he was learning on the fields and the men he was surrounded by, and what he was seeing in his daily life, the injustice that he was seeing in his daily life. So he did come out very, very tough. And Dr. Dawn Mabalon, when she was alive, and Andre Sabayan, when we were creating this book, we would laugh and say we wanted to make a second book called Manongs After Dark. And we would laugh because, Manongs is, it's a respectful term for an older, familiar member of your community in Ilocano, the dialect Ilocano in the Philippines. And we would laugh because the Manongs of this time, the Filipinos who were laborers who had come in and had already been in the United States for, decades by the time we get to 1965, were tough. You know, if you messed with them, they would find you at night and they would write the situation. And they were taught, by their own experiences that they had to be ready for anything. In fact, we were laughing because there's something called an Ilocano knife that a man carries in his pocket. To always be ready. And to this day, Andre Sabayan, our illustrator, he started laughing when we started talking about this because he said, "You guys are not going to believe this because I have an Ilocano knife in my pocket."
Well, so good to have you again. And thank you so much for filling in this time while we try to connect with our guest, Inez Smith. Good to have had you. And I appreciate very much your being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And now we'll transition to our guest, Dinesh Smith. He's a black, queer, non-binary poet. Dinesh Smith first captured the public's attention back in 2014 with a viral video performance of that poem you heard earlier, Dear White America. Dinesh, who I'll note for our listeners uses gender-neutral pronouns, has since gone on to receive a number of awards for their work, including the Forward Prize, as well as fellowships with the Poetry Foundation, Cave Canem, and National Endowment for the Arts, just to name a few. And now they are the author of a new book of poetry, Homie. Here with me to talk about is Dinesh Smith. Good to have you.
Hey, good to be here. Sorry I'm late.
Yeah, sorry you're late, too. I had lots to talk about with you, and now I have to truncate that and mark it shorter. But, boy, there is a lot. We actually both have roots at UW-Madison. And
I hated that place.
Well, I'm sorry. I loved it. But that has to do with maybe different parts of our lives. There are other places I hated, too. In fact, I was just reading about you getting reading your work in connection with the T.S. Eliot Four Quartets Award. And I was thinking, boy, T.S. Eliot, who I studied a lot in Madison, was such a staid and Anglican kind of poet. And what a contrast. I mean, your poetry is so full of vulnerability and vitality and life to it. And I'm not even talking about the rhythms here. I'm talking about just your willingness to, well, put it all out there and also sing and celebrate with joy, but also let us know what you're suffering and what you're going through. Let me just give you the plaudit that I feel you deserve for the work that you've put out there. And I know this work is different because Homie is a work that's not necessarily what we heard earlier, where maybe you're thinking about white people or the white gaze, or they're not in your mind or your heart as much in this poem. It's mainly your people, your tribe.
Yeah, it's a much more intimate collection than Don't Call Us Dead was. I've been saying that it's different because even though I feel like I've always been speaking to these larger audiences or these larger like swaths of who I'm considering the we or the you in the poem, now it's I feel like I can name who this book is for. You know, I can call them, I can text them, I can miss them, I can pray for them. It's a little bit different, and so it changes the tenor of the work. I think I've always been trying to cull some vulnerability, especially since there's always some element of confession in my work. But yeah, the you is a lot more personal, right? It is named. It is a book of names and of people and people that I know and touch and love. And, you know,
there's a lot of confessional, if I may say so, Dinesh. And
yeah,
at the center of this, in fact, is queer identity. And it's such a strange word for somebody who came up the way I did because, you know, when I was a kid, the word queer carried all that stigma with it and all that nastiness and shame that you write about. But now we have queer studies and we have, you know, the word being put into a whole different frame and a whole different non-pejorative kind of association. And talk about that a little bit, because when you talk about queerness, you're talking about being naked in terms of who you are and what you are, but also you know, you feel a lot of the sense of being intruded upon as someone who's black and someone who has HIV.
Yeah, I think the intruded upon is maybe more of a Don't Call Us Dead thing. I think in Homie, you know, I think it may be just because I'm older. I've been me for 30 years now, and I feel comfortable in it in a way maybe that I haven't been before. You know, queerness or like all these things that I think a lot of my early work, yeah, well, did have this larger project of doing away with shame, but now it just is, you know, queer and whatever other things that I can take on in my, or whatever identities I walk alongside, whether that be blackness or, you know, queerness in terms of sexuality or in terms of gender or whatever it may be. Sure, there's a nakedness, but they're also adornment, right? And so I think Homie itself is very much adorned with those identities and is trying to, it's not interested in shame at all. It's interested in celebration. It's interested in bedazzling those things and showing them for how grand they are.
I'm looking at a note here also that says, to listeners who call and write in, Dinesh uses the pronouns they, them, and theirs. And I want to ask you about that in a moment, but let me take the opportunity to invite listeners to join us. I know you have a lot of fans out there and a lot of people who'd like to talk to you. If you have questions for Dinesh or memories of seeing them perform in the Bay Area, you can give us a call right now at our toll-free number and join the program. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. Or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email questions to forum@kqed.org. Let's talk about them. As an old English teacher, I used to say when somebody had him or her and then had them, you know, you sort of circle it and say, you got to have your pronouns in agreement here. The insistence on they, A lot of people would say, I don't understand that. That's not the way I was brought up. That's not traditional by my standards. Why this insistence? Let's talk about why it's so important to you.
I mean, first of all, I think I kind of question this question of tradition. Who would we be if we did not break the rules and break the laws of those who came before us, right? You know, I mean, America, as messed up of a project as it is, was founded on that very idea that we were going to throw a whole bunch of tea into the water and not do things as they used to be, right? You know, I can read right now. It is not illegal for me to read and write right now because somebody said that couldn't be anymore. So to hell with tradition. When it comes to in the world we live in and the way we think about our own bodies, you know, like people have been, I mean, I don't think the idea of gender non-binary folks or transgender folks, it's not new, at all, you know, to a larger Western imagination, but you know, it's been in our people, in our blood, in our land, and who we are for centuries, for millennia. And so, you know, it's just appearing in the English language like that. For me, genderqueerness is a chance to, imagine, what feels right for me, right? And I don't even know if they, them is the right word, but it feels good. It's a good landing place to say that, I exist in a way that, or I am in a way that is outside of this strict binary between, man and woman, butch and femme, right? That there's a lot between there and a lot beyond and a lot that we never know. And if I don't have the freedom to imagine myself any other way, I don't think I want to be here. That's the funnest part of life is getting to find the way to do it right, the way you need to get the living done. So
you're talking about authenticity,
aren't
you?
Time, you know, like,
aren't you talking about authenticity, genuineness, really?
I am authenticity, you know, and I think the freedom to creatively imagine yourself into whatever forms and whatever languages that feel just for you. You don't have to settle for what's already there. And even with they, them, you know, if you really want to get linguistic with it, we use they, them all the time, right? Whose pen is that? Oh, that's their pen over there. You know, you talk about Johnny, you know, it's just as easy to say him or her, but in the English language, right, in many different dialects, we already use the they, them. The language is already there. We're just bringing it on abundantly and in new ways, and people are finding power in that language. And that's the wonderful part I love about English. It's a bastard language anyway. Why not be messy with it? Why not find new things to do with it? You know, I'm a poet. You know, poets are never interested in just using the same old words in the same way.
May I say, Dinesh, you're not just a poet. You're also a performer.
I try to be.
Yeah, and I've got a listener, John, who wants to talk about this pronoun controversy. John, go ahead. You're on with us.
Oh, Lord, John.
I thought up primarily about the poetry first because I enjoy your poetry, but bringing up the issue of gender neutrality is important to me right now because I am very concerned about my granddaughter. I want her to be able to, she's gender exploring right now, and she would prefer to be called Z or Zer. And I was curious, one of the things that bothers me about they and them is that it can be confusing when speaking or when even writing down, whereas Z and Zer, they're so unique that they have a clear expression of gender neutrality.
Thoughts from you, Dinesh?
Yeah. Yay for your grandchild, and looking and trying to find the language that feels right for them. There's here and here, Z and Zier. You know, some people just want to be called their name. Some people want the plural pronoun. Some people feel comfortable in two different pronouns. There's all different kinds of way that, gender neutral, gender fluid, gender not conforming folks, language and identify themselves. And I think, John, I think the biggest point is that you love your grandchild and you have a concern. And so it might be messy, right? My mom always calls me her non-binary son, right? That's Dinesh. He's non-binary. And like, you know, I understand that language is tricky. And I think even in a space of love, we have room to mess up. We have room because we know the intention is right. You know, and I think as long as you continue loving and being in your grandchild's life, that you are going to, you know, you'll get it right. And they might continue changing too. And amen to that.
And as I wanted you to read a poem,
enough to explore herself.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted you to read a poem because we're coming short on time and we have to take a break in about a minute or so. I wanted listeners to just get a feel for your poetry. Can you read something for us? Your choice?
Yeah, you wanted
something that's short because we do have to go to a break.
Yeah, we'll do this one. This is called "I'm Going Back to Minnesota Where Sadness Makes Sense."
That was one of the ones I thought I might ask you to read because it brings in California. Go ahead.
Yeah. Where I used to live for a little bit. All right. Oh, California, don't you know the sun is only a god if you learn to starve for her? I'm over the ocean. I stood at its lip, dressed in down, praying for snow. I know I'm strange. Too much light makes me nervous, at least in this land where the trees always bear green. I know something that doesn't die can't be beautiful. Have you ever stood on a frozen lake, California? The sun above you, the snow installed sea, a field of mirror, all demanding to be the sun. Everything around you is light and it's gorgeous. And if you stay too long, it will kill you. It's so sad, you know. You're the only warm thing for miles, the only thing that can't shine.
Yeah, I like it. And I like the fact that you really bring it home, so to speak, to St. Paul, which is where you come from. And where you were born and raised, in a very devout Baptist, God-fearing home, I should add. Mm-hmm. And I also want to mention the fact that you really came into prominence in 2014. We heard White America, Dear White America, before. That was a breakthrough in many ways for you. But you started writing poetry in high school, I believe, didn't you?
Yes. Back in ninth grade theater class, wrote my first poem. Yeah.
And so now you are very much in the limelight, and I know you have some mixed feelings about that. In fact, I was reading some remarks you were making about it. Reminded me of Tennessee Williams, who when he had a big hit, when he had a lot of fame and people started really noticing him, he said, you know, I don't know if this is good. I got to really deal with this now.
I think it is. And Tennessee Williams, like, you know, like me, I think queens have trouble once you actually start calling them things like that. The limelight is not, it doesn't do well. I am, I'm a Leo. I don't know if that means anything to you, but that means that I am
not much, but that's okay.
It means I'm prone to delight in my ego a little bit. Sometimes to good ends and sometimes to not so great ones. And, you know, the success of Don't Call Us Dead really did impede upon me working on Homie for a while, just because I feeling that same imposter syndrome. Oh, I did it once. What if I could never do it again? Every poem kind of had the pressure, not just to be the poem that it needed to be, but that it had to perform and succeed in a certain kind of way that would mean success on the other end and not just success in the process or discovery in the process. And it took me a long time to really get back to a place where I could write poems, because I needed to write poems still. And I needed to really get back to the root of what sent me to the art, because good Lord, nobody knows you. You don't become a poet if you want to be famous. And so, you know, and being a famous poet is like being a very popular, I don't know, dog catcher or something like that. So, so I had to really get back to the roots of why I do this thing. And it was good. And then it makes me a little bit more comfortable recognizing that it's not something I have to deny, that, you know, I have some type of power or influence, or that, you know, now.
Man, you got a following. You got a big following. And I just want to remind listeners, we're talking to Dinesh Smith, who is poet, author of Homie, winner of the Forward Prize for Best Collection of Poetry, and recipient of the fellowships from Poetry Foundation, McKnight Foundation, Cave Canem, and the National Endowment for the Arts, just to give him his due here in terms of his props and their props, excuse me. And you're listening to Forum. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And you notice how I made that mistake, and it's common, I guess, with you, even with people with the best intentions. So they want to call you they, and they slip into the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it happens, you know, and I think, you know, there are some days when we're a little bit more patient with it, some days not. And I think, you know, that is up to every queer, genderqueer, trans person to decide for themselves how they want to approach folks who, and I think you got to understand if folks are a little bit more peeved at you or annoyed with you when you do that slippage, because it's our bodies, it's our lives. You want to be seen the way you see. And I think, you know, there is maybe a certain measure of grace that comes with it when people are still learning. We understand that language is always catching up and getting further away from it.
Now we can hope for grace, indeed. And speaking of grace, I was interested in reading that one of your favorite poets, who is one of my favorite poets, is Lucille Clifton. Give her lots of props. But who else are sort of your iconic stellar figures in the world of poetry? Who are you most drawn to?
Lucille Clifton, Patricia Smith, Ross Gay, Amy Nezuko Mattadl, Lee Young Lee. I feel like I'm gonna forget everybody. Douglas Kearney. I really feel like I walk alongside a lot of brilliant contemporaries, folks like Angel Nafis and Hanif Abdurraqi, Morgan Parker, Franny Choi, Nae Marshall, Fatima Oscar, Sam Sachs, Hugh Nguyen, Safa Helo.
Sam Sachs is a local.
On and on. Yeah. Sam Sachs is a local. And a beloved. And like, you know, before either of us had any type of weight behind our names, me and Sam would be up at 3 a.m. trading poems over Facebook message, right, across the country. And so those are the folks that I really feel lovely, really feel blessed to see blossom, because we all knew each other when we had poem and maybe $2, a poem and $2 that were up together, right? And so, yeah, it's good to walk alongside these folks and be able to see the poems make their ways into the world, because these folks have been bright in my heart for a while.
Well, it's good of you to name all those folks. In fact, Sam Sachs and I actually served as judges in a literary event a while ago, which was quite an extraordinary experience. I wanted to ask you quickly, because we don't have as much time with you as I wanted, but you write a poem about a white girl that you picked on, and it was a very compelling poem to me, because there was kind of an apology in it, but also a taking on of a mantle of guilt and an understanding of what you put her through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was for my kindergarten girlfriend, Rose. Yeah, Rose. And I was just thinking about her one day. You know, I don't know about other folks, but I often wake up in the middle of the night thinking about something petty and evil, or large and evil, that I did from, you know, a year, 10 years, 20 years ago. And I think Rose was one of the people that often shook me out of my sleep, just thinking about how easy it was to be cruel to her. And in writing Homie, I tried to, I had a lot of very unsuccessful poems that I didn't include about hate, but I needed something to try to mediate about what it means to be, not to be a bad friend, but just to be a bad person, which I think is the opposite of being a friend, is when, how do you treat people when you are completely devoid of empathy, sympathy, or care for them.
Well, your empathy comes through, and let me congratulate you on this
now.
And
I wish I had it then. I wish young Dinez could have saw that.
Earlier versions of my life, I wish I was more empathic too. But you know, at this point, we can just try to be in the present and be as empathic as we possibly can. And your empathy comes through in your work and in this conversation with you as well. So good to have you with us. Thank you.
Good to have you. Is that I got five on it, I hear? Oh, this is a blessed conversation. Thank you for having me on.
No. Yeah, Houdini Friends, who you mentioned in your poetry.
Houdini. Oh, Houdini. Oh, my God. This is who it is. Oh, I'm crying now. It's Houdini.
Dinez Smith, the book, Homie. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.